Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 18, 2005. This is Doug Henwood and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. I'm still on vacation, so I'm coming to you on recording, just like last week. If Hugh Hamilton's crick cooperates, I'll be back in person next week. Two interviews up for tonight. First, the full interview I recorded a few weeks ago with Barbara Ehrenreich about the state of organized labor in the U.S. I never got to broadcast it in full because it was early in the emergency fundraiser and I was trying to raise money with appropriate desperation. And second, an interview recorded last week with Ian Boll, one of the authors of a book just out from Verso called Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War. No news headlines tonight because I recorded this more than a week ago, and I can't yet foretell the future. Let's listen to this 32-year-old relic to set up the interview with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Before the union did appear, my life was half as clear. Now I've got the power to the working hour and every other day of the year. So though I'm a working man, I can ruin the government's plan. I'm not too hard, but the sight of my car makes me some kind of Superman. Oh.
That was the Straubs, an excerpt from the 1973 song, Part of the Union. And we've come a long way from that, both in their home country of Britain and here in the USA. Unions are weak and on their backs. Polls show a lot of Americans would like to join a union, exactly how many differs by the poll you read, but can't. Polls also show Americans have an ambivalent attitude towards unions. Although I'm quite pro-union, it is true that all too often they act like special interests, more interested in their own privilege than in the general welfare. I recorded this interview with Barbara Ehrenreich on the eve of the AFL-CIO convention, which saw four large unions leave the Federation, complaining that the labor establishment wasn't doing enough to organize the unorganized. What we speak of here in the future tense actually happened, so nothing really needs to be changed here other than the verb tenses. I called Ehrenreich because she had had an excellent article in the Progressive magazine listing some of the things that unions could do better. She is, of course, famous as the author of Nickel and Dimed, her research into work in low-wage America. Her book, Bait and Switch, on the travails of the middle class, will be out in a couple of months, and I'll have her back to talk about it then. Barbara Ehrenreich.
So the AFL-CIO is facing a big meeting in the next couple of days. What's your prognosis as they go into what could be a possible schism?
I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know anybody who does know. Maybe there will be a last-minute kind of compromise, but things look pretty bitter right now.
Well, let's evaluate some of the critique that the Andy Stern and the people around the SEIU are very critical of the labor movement for failing to commit any serious resources to organizing. On the other hand, had Bill Fletcher on the other week to talk about how the Stern critique was remarkably absent of any kind of political agenda. What do you think of the issues at hand?
Well, what does he mean by a political agenda?
Anything like a substance of what the labor movement should be standing for politically.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose Bill Fletcher is right about that. But I think that just not even going into the realm of, say, electoral politics and or party politics or any of that, there are some things I would like to see being addressed that aren't being addressed or things that, you know, I think the important thing that Stern has raised is the amount of resources the AFL-CIO commits to organizing, which is not enough. You know, that's been the big issue. And not only is it not enough, but, you know, if compared to what they spend, say, on donations to the Democratic Party and various candidates, I think, and Tom Gagin, a labor lawyer in Chicago, has argued that it would actually make more sense if you want to help the Democrats to organize. Because everybody knows, and it was true in 2000, it was true in 2004, that people, union members are much more likely to vote Democratic. So you want people to vote Democratic. Don't give millions of dollars to the Democratic Party, which will spend it on TV commercials. Put it into organizing, which makes people really think about their economic self-interest, and that would do a lot more for Democratic candidates.
Do you think the unions get anything in return for their huge amounts of investment in the Democratic Party?
That's up for them to, you know, I don't know how to evaluate that. But we, you know, we haven't been getting much, partly because the Democrats are so outnumbered in Congress. But I think, you know, I don't understand this huge emphasis on supporting the Democratic Party as opposed to building the unions. And I think maybe it's true that the time has run out for that. You know, that it's, you know, it's run the unions into the ground, to a in a sense.
The president of the Machinist Union had a remarkably dumb letter circulating the other week in which he says that the problem isn't that the labor movement is shrinking, it's that the labor force is growing. The labor movement is just as big as it ever was, but it's just that as a percentage of the labor force, that's shrinking. I think. Do you think there's any merit to that argument?
Well, I think that's sort of putting your head in the sand. No, there's a problem here. The labor movement is organizing. You know, they have impressive numbers for the last few years under Sweeney, but at the same time, it's, you know, the United States loses unionized manufacturing jobs so quickly that it, you know, it amounts to a net loss.
When you were doing the research for Nickel and Dimed, what kind of attitudes did you find among low-wage workers about unions? Were they interested in joining them? Did they have a positive image of unions? How did they think about them?
Well, I would bring up the subject. Because, you know, people were always complaining in these low-wage jobs about the lack of benefits, about, you know, management practices, about wages. And I'd say, when no manager was around to hear, I'd say, did you ever think about a union? And, you know, I never got a response like, oh, no, I hate unions or something like that. The saddest response, from my point of view, I ever got was a young woman saying, what exactly is a union? Now, something's really wrong when a blue-collar worker and a, you know, pretty smart young woman in this case could ask that question. They're just not a visible force, as they should be to the great majority of American workers who are not organized.
What about, you know, to use the old language, the level of class consciousness among the workers you were working with? Did they think of themselves as working class? Did they think that collective organization could do anything for them? Or did they just think of themselves as sort of lonely atoms bouncing around in a hostile world?
I think more the latter. You know, I think there's a difference between class consciousness and having a faith in collective action. You know, a lot of people were resentful, they were angry, they knew there's something wrong and that some people are getting awfully rich while other people just can't make it. But it's another thing to make the leap to say, well, we can change it if we band together. I saw people more likely, you know, doing small acts of defiance or smirking or making fun of the boss or doing something that we were not supposed to do, like in some settings, swear words. So, you know, I think that that's a larger problem in American culture, is that since the great days of, say, the civil rights movement and the women's movement, you know, and the surge of union activism in the 60s and 70s, people don't see a lot of examples of collective action actually changing things. And we're, you know, our whole culture says, no, it's all you, you know. It's all up to you. If you have the right attitude, if you work hard enough, you will get ahead. It has nothing to do with other people.
And to take a little tangent, but not totally out of line, you were working mostly with women, low-wage women. Did they have any thoughts about feminism, organized women's movement, or is that completely off their radar screen, too?
Oh, no, not off their radar screen at all. And I was working with men also, I should say, but I had one woman who I worked with in a restaurant take me aside and kind of explain feminism to me. You know, she just said, you know, everybody in charge here is men, and we have to stick together. I was amazed and delighted. And women seem to be very aware of sexual harassment as a problem and the fact that it was illegal and they had recourses.
The recourses, though, more in the way of litigation than organization?
Yeah, I mean, recourses which you're not in practice going to very likely to undertake because of the cost of lawyers and all that. But, there was a lot of awareness of that you shouldn't have to put up with that. Unfortunately, that's only one of the things working women have to put up with, and probably not the biggest.
Oh, my aunt-in-law, Jane Mansbridge, the feminist political scientist, did a poll or commissioned a poll for some research she's doing and found out that something like 80% of American women have called a man a male chauvinist pig at some time in their lives. So there is some...
80%?
How about that?
I know what that tells us about women or men.
Something about both, I guess.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's turn to the topic of your fine column in the August issue, the progressive tiny labor. Of course, we're used to big labor, but you're saying it's pretty tiny now, right?
Yeah, and my complaint is that it continues to act like the right-wing stereotype of, quote, big labor. We haven't had big labor in, 30, 40 years. It's dwindled, and I think it's one of its problems is it hasn't adjusted to that. A big sign to me, and I'm not the only one who said this. Jonathan Tessini, who has a wonderful website about American, about working people and union issues.
And who was a guest in this program about a month ago, talking about just those things.
Oh yeah, okay. Do you know his URL so we could tell people?
I'll plug it at the end.
Okay. He said the unions suffer from an edifice complex. They are sitting on what he estimates is at least $1 billion worth of real estate in Washington, D.C., between the Teamsters building and the AFL-CIO building, which is palatial. That might have been all right for a different era, although I would question it then, too. What I would like to see a labor movement now that is accepts its tininess and scales down in terms of the buildings and the trappings and things like that, is willing to operate out of storefronts and church basements or wherever, and presents a kind of a lean, mean, fighting spirit that is accessible to people.
Well, you also complain in the column that the union movement has not at all shed the heritage of Gompers business unionism. What do you mean by that, and what's the problem with it?
Well, the Gompers business union model, and Samuel Gompers was the head of the AFL in the 1920s, in the 10s, was, you join us, you give us dues, and we'll give you the following things. It's like an insurance policy. Join us, we can, we'll protect you from unfair job loss, we'll see that your wages go up, and so on. A kind of a quid pro quo. That is very different from a model of unions as for institutions of a movement. It says, join us, we're going to fight for better conditions for you and everybody. You are not just giving us dues so you'll get these things. You are becoming part of a crusading effort to transform this society and end economic injustice.
Yeah, they have some kind of a service idea, not that they're even offering credit cards. They're just a service-providing organization.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a business model, but it's not a movement model.
You're also suggesting that they change the model of membership. What did you have in mind there?
Well, this is a subject that Tom Gagin, who is one of labor's real intellectuals, has raised again and again. Why can't we join unions as individuals out of an identification with the working class cause? If I as a feminist and a woman... you could be a man, too, to join now. I just have to send in my dues to the National Organization for Women, and I signal my support. They can count me as a member. They keep me up to date on relevant issues and so on. Now, I think there should be something like that for unions. European unions generally have individual members. You don't have to wait till your entire workplace is organized to become a union member. And then, you know, those people who are individual union members may, you know, be the seeds of an organizing drive in their workplace. But as it is now, you're an American worker, you want to become a union member, then you have to go through this real trial by fire of trying to organize your work, your whole workplace, and it may very well lead to your being fired.
Back during the, a little more than 10 years ago, back when Clinton was proposing his disastrous health insurance reform, there were some reports that the unions weren't necessarily very enthusiastic about offering some kind of universal national program because that would lose a selling point for unions. Are they that cynical and selfish, do you think?
Well, you know, I have had some disturbing conversations with union organizers and staff members who said, oh, well, we don't really have to worry about universal health insurance because we're going to get that for our members. You know, they'll get health insurance if they join us. Well, I don't think that should be the stance. You know, I prodded and sort of goaded one person who said that to me by saying, well, would you actually oppose universal health insurance then because it would make it harder for you to organize? And she, oh, no, of course not. I said, then, well, listen to what you're saying. You know, the chances that we're all going to be covered by health insurance through our through being organized into unions are pretty slim. You know, it's going to that's looking at, you know, quite a long term project. Like to see it happen, but it's awfully long term. In the meantime, the union should be representing everybody, and you know, be playing a leading role in the fight for universal health insurance for everybody. Maybe I feel pretty strongly about this in part because my union, the National Writers Union, has lost its health insurance. The you know, it was a big selling point of the union for freelance writers. And then two large insurance companies in a row dumped us. So we can't get health insurance for our union anymore. And I think the response to that kind of thing has to be, well, all right, we can't depend on these private carriers. We can't do this one union local or shop at a time. This is a nationwide fight.
Well, the standard right-wing critique of unions, well, one of several, is that they're special interest groups. It seems sometimes that it's a little too easy to make that charge stick, isn't it?
Unfortunately, the smaller unions become, the more they do look like a special interest group. If they, even though their membership is relatively small now, would take on this role of advocating for the entire working class, and I'm willing to define that very generously, then they cannot be called a special interest group. You're talking about the majority of Americans. And, of course, one big step in that direction would be to allow for individual memberships.
And then what else? I mean, we talked about health insurance. What else do you think would be key to some sort of political vision, political agenda?
One of my pet concerns, having done the work I did for Nickel and Dimed, is that work that unions need to fight for rights, human rights, civil rights in the workplace. We need a civil rights movement in the workplace. When you go to work, and in most situations, and this includes white-collar people, you basically check your civil rights at the door. You surrender rights to privacy. If you're a blue-collar person, this may mean that your purse or backpack can be searched, looking, of course, the excuse is always looking for things you might have stolen, but they might be just as well looking for union literature. If you're a white-collar person, it can mean that your email and website use, even at lunch hour, is monitored by the boss. And, you have no rights of, you know, no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly. I worked in two places during the Nickel and Dime researches where you were not supposed to even talk to your fellow workers. I want to see unions really take this on and not just talk about the right to organize, but talk about human rights and civil rights in general in the workplace. I don't think you can have a society that prides itself on being a democracy if people spend 8 or 10 hours a day in what amounts to a dictatorship.
I believe you're doing research now on a book on middle-class, white-collar people. Do you find any kind of potential labor consciousness among them, or are they just as atomized and resigned as the people in the low-wage sector?
Well, actually, the work is done, and the book will be out in September. It's called Bait and Switch on the Feudal Search for the American Dream. And I was looking at people who are unemployed or very anxiously employed, white-collar people who, have been downsized, right-sized, rift, reorg. There are all these euphemisms for the churning that goes on in the white-collar world. And no, I think they're pretty beaten down. And I think part of it, and this is a lot of what the book is about, has to do with the fact that they, when they lose a job and enter this kind of nether world of unemployment, they are confronted with an ideology coming from career coaches and networking events and support groups that says it's all your fault. You know, if you were laid off, you probably had a bad attitude. Now you have to upgrade that attitude and just accept whatever comes your way. That's sort of who moved my cheese philosophy. Just accept whatever is done to you and scamper like a little rodent after the next piece of cheese.
Or go to a megachurch and experience the gospel of uplift. You conclude the column with a call towards dumping the business union model and promoting a feeling of solidarity. It seems that Americans are so atomized and resigned that that message might be a hard one to sell. Do you really think we could organize a new kind of real, or as Labor Notes people say, put the movement back in the labor movement? Do you think you can do that, organizing around solidarity?
Well, I think solidarity is a union's secret weapon, just as sisterhood is a women's movement secret weapon. That is it's an uplifting force to feel connected to other people, feel united with other people, gain that strength, and feel that you are actually stepping into history to make major, major changes. Now, that's something that's enormously powerful. When people grasp it emotionally, intellectually, and so forth. And I think the unions need to be evangelical about promoting that.
All right, well, thanks for joining us, Barbara, and I look forward to talking to you in September when Bait and Switch is out.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you about that one.
I'm really looking forward to it.
I think I got some help from you. You're acknowledged.
Oh, thank you.
That was Barbara Ehrenreich in an interview recorded for my July 21st show, but only broadcast in a severely truncated form because of fundraising. Let's take a break for station ID.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
And we're back. This is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, and now a musical setup for Ian Bowl.
Here we go again, this day's the greatest show on heaven and earth.
That was an excerpt from The Empire Strikes First by Bad Religion. The Empire doesn't always strike first. It was struck first and hard itself on September 11, 2001. Ian Boll is one of four authors who go by the name Retort of the book Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War, just out from Verso. It's a look at things like oil, war, empire, Iraq, 9/11, and revolutionary Islam. It's not an easy read, and it offers as many questions as answers, but it seems to me that's just what we need right now, since reality isn't exactly transparent and self-evident at the moment. A definition. We speak in the early part of the interview of Hubbert's peak, or peak oil. That's the idea that global oil production is at or near a peak and will shortly start to decline if it hasn't already started to do so. I don't buy this, but a lot of people do. More of that in a future show. And an observation, war isn't always good for business. It may be a long-term necessity for the health of capitalism, which is yet another item in the long indictment of capitalism, but it's rare that the business itself is always aching to go to war. I interviewed an oil industry economist on this show a couple of years ago who said that big oil wasn't really hot to invade Iraq. So was the invasion of Iraq something that emerged out of the deep structures of American capitalism, or was it an adventure pursued by a fraction of our ruling class? I lean towards the latter explanation, but the case is far from closed. Okay, let's listen now to Ian Boll.
First of all, a little background about Retort. Who are you, and what was the process of the composition of Afflicted Powers?
Well, thanks for having me on, Doug. Yeah, we call ourselves a gathering of antagonists to capital and empire. We've been based, we're perhaps 30 or 40 strong. It's rather loose. It's not a collective as such. We've been based in the Bay Area here out in California for about 2 decades now. And we produced a pamphlet at the time of the first Gulf War. And then in the spring of 2003, at the time of the huge manifestations around the world, we felt that we couldn't go into the streets, which we were going to do and we intended and we did, without producing some document, because we were unhappy with marching, as we predicted, and it turned out to be the case, under the sign of peace. We felt that peace was needed some critique, the very idea of peace at this moment. And we also predicted that we would also be invited to march under the slogan of no blood for oil, and we were unhappy with that too. And so we produced a broadsheet, 17 by 11, and we made thousands and thousands of those, and it was actually entitled Neither Their War Nor Their Peace. And this book, Afflicted Powers, just out from Verso, is a bloated version of that original broadside. We thought we'd do another pamphlet, but it got too big.
And before we get to the substance of your analysis, let's just do a little intellectual ground clearing first. You don't think that Bush knew or Cheney did it, referring to 9/11, of course?
No, we don't. I don't think the evidence is there for that. There was plenty of warning. I'm sure that the 9/11 report contains holes and lies, and there are a lot of people having to cover themselves. But we certainly are not conspiracists of that kind, and we believe conspiracy theories of that kind is, in many ways, is a neo-Orientalism. It imputes no agency to, you know, quote the enemy. I mean, as if only the American puppet masters can make anything happen in the world. Now, of course, the irony is that the conspiracy is not just widely held on a certain on the left here and among many Americans, but of course is very, very widely held in the Middle East and the Islamic world itself. So there's plenty of people who do take the position, of course, that you suggest. We certainly don't, and we lay out in the book, you know, what we believe to be a more reasonable explanation, and it has nothing, you know, to do with, you know, a conspiracy.
You said that you had severe problems with the slogan "No Blood for Oil," and you know, we look back at the history of U.S. military interventions over the last 10 or 20 years. We see Kosovo. People tried to find some kind of Caspian pipeline connection with that. Somalia. There was supposed to be an oil connection. Some of those seem like a pretty far reach. The Afghanistan gas pipeline, you know, some of this seemed like kind of a reach. But when it comes to Iraq, it does seem that oil is at the center of that. Iraq has gigantic oil reserves, and does seem that's a case, that's an instance where it's rather easy to make the case that this intervention was about oil. What is your problem with the that slogan, "No blood for oil"?
Yes. Well, that's right. Of course, it seems central, and in certain way it is, and we would certainly insist on its centrality up to a point. And in fact, we begin the chapter "Blood for Oil?" With putting the strongest case we can for the position that that oil is what explains the invasion of Iraq, and it seems quite persuasive. And then and I can't do it. I think people would have to read the chapter to see the details of the argument. Let me just say this much about it, which is that capitalism, certainly at this stage, is never only about one commodity, even as central a commodity as oil. It has to be seen on the larger terrain. And even if you concede the centrality of oil, and certainly we do that, in the modern world, I mean, technologically, how could it not be? It's the condition of possibility of everything else, in a way, as a commodity. And yet, if you ask the question, well, why on earth would you want to control the actual wellheads? I mean, the history of oil has always been, about deals and manipulations. And the price, it turns out, has a very, very, it's not a tight couple with respect to availability of oil, let's put it that way. And in fact, the history of oil is like many, perhaps all other commodities in the history of capitalism. It's about the production of scarcity. This is something that may come to a shock to some people, that actually the problem has historically been about glut. Now, the argument, the reply to that would be, well, aren't we now, given Hubbard's peak, the new fetish of peak oil, aren't we in a different situation? Well, we lay out in the chapter the insider positions on this, and there's massive disagreement about when this peak will come. And frankly, it could be a few years, it could be 100 years. It's got many different variables. But even if the peak comes next year, from the point of view of the price of oil and geopolitics, it certainly doesn't require the invasion of Iraq, for sure. Now, we do say that there's many important things to say about oil, geopolitics, the fact that a hell of a lot of oil in the world happens, historically, to be under lands that are Islamic, for example. But we quote Sheikh Yomani, who said, I think truly, that remember that the Stone Age did not end for want of stone. And we, of course, would like the oil age to be over, but not for the same reasons that the Malthusians think that it will come to an end, that we're close to running out of oil.
Well, it's as if the Malthusians sort of want the oil age to end for ecological or social or aesthetic reasons. So they're imagining that the peak will be thrust upon us, whether we want it or not. But
yes, I'm afraid that's wishful. It's not going to happen that way. Of course, we should be weaning ourselves off hydrocarbons in this way. I mean, we may well be heading for catastrophe. I mean, I work in environmental politics myself, and I'm very aware of the Malthusianism that's quite rife among critics of the present order, and the various arguments, ecological arguments, and which are very, very complex about climate change and so on. But I'm afraid we've got to have a grown-up history of oil. We cannot imagine that if Hubbard's peak happens this year, that we're going to be coming off oil anytime soon.
I'm speaking with Ian Bull, who is one of the authors, member of the Retort Group, of the book Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in an Age of War, just out from Verso. And other people will argue that even if we're not upon the peak of oil at this moment, that control of Iraq provides important political leverage that the U.S. can exercise over Europe, Japan, China, that this is ultimately a kind of geostrategic war about the maintenance of U.S. Preeminence in the world. What do you think of that argument?
Well, that's closer to it. I think that's really true, and what in important ways. I would want to qualify it a bit, but yes, and that's the reason why after the blood for oil section, we go straight into a long section in which we combine our sort of critique of peace, in other words, the signs under which the anti-war movement marches, and with a long and, you know, frankly, depressing account of U.S. The U.S. Imperial war machine, which goes back really to the beginnings of this society, where the native commoners of North America were dispossessed, and I mean the enclosure took quite a long time. I mean, you know, they imagined the they imagined the dispossession before it happened. The Northwest Ordinance, which sort of gridded out North America, and you can see from a plane when you travel across the patchwork. That's the cadastral survey of as the Western Anglos punched their way over the Appalachian crest in the late 18th century. And the early so-called fathers of this republic were very comfortable with the word empire. They used the word empire. They were positive about it in the same way that they were positive and unironic about, you know, the virtues of civilization. But they were very clear what the project was. And we have absolutely no hesitation in trying yet again to explode the idea that America as an empire in that sense is exceptional. We have, you know, very little truck with freedom and liberty. And so the expansionism has always been there. And we have, we lay out a very sort of gruesome history of dispossession and militarism and the way that this war machine works. And there's a sense in which, you know, the invasion of Iraq is of a piece. Now, what's interesting to us, given the, I think, as I started with Doug, telling you that afflicted powers begins on the streets of San Francisco for us. And it's very important that we, you know, we were very moved by the staggering numbers that came out and the democracy deficit, as they say, around the world that revealed itself those weekends in the spring of 2003. What was fascinating to us there was that those who've been in the anti-globalization struggle thought back to Seattle of 1999. And I doubt whether, you know, somebody, maybe some of the listeners at BAI could, who were there, might be able to remember, but I don't, a slogan which spoke of, you know, American empire and the war machine. At Seattle, the WTO, the suits in the suites, thought that they were going to be able to continue the dispossession and the structural adjustment, you know, without the tanks and the planes and the bombers, right? No one in the South, maybe, few people in the South, who are much more familiar with the iron fist and the way capital and the military work together historically, they might not have been under any illusion, but many of us were, and in late 1999. And so what the book does is try to get to grips and try to think of an explanation of what it was that caused this mutation from essentially something that was like the parliamentary enclosures of the around 1800, you know, when the residual peasantries of the British Isles were dispossessed by the stroke of a pen in Parliament, and the landlords had seized control of Parliament by that time. They didn't need to do it with blood and fire. And maybe that was the case. And maybe that the WTO thought, or many of them thought, that they could do it that way. And I'm sure those ideas still are there. But, you know, after Genoa and Cancun and Miami and now Iraq, something has changed. And we're trying to get the measure of that in Afflicted Powers. And we come up with a new phrase, actually, which we feel needed to be coined to capture this moment of, this bizarre moment of what seems like crude return to an imperial past, right? Like a 19th century imperialism, like the gunboat diplomacy. Plus this new, you know, at the same time as this new, these new technologies of the virtual and communications, which I'm sure were in the minds of those who struck the Twin Towers, that, you know, a picture is 1,000 words. They didn't say anything. It was enough to mean some kind of strategic defeat for U.S. empire and capital. And we're trying to understand what this current moment is, the connection between neoliberalism, you know, this stage of capitalism, and the war machine.
Well, sometimes it does look like, to some degree, a faction fight within the American elite. The Clinton years representing a kind of a Wall Street market-oriented approach, and the Bush years representing the oil extractive industries and the arms industry, but just a different faction of capitalism.
Yes, I think that's a very, very good point, and I agree with you. I think that I agree with what you're saying, that there are factions and there are certain, you know, there are tendencies, and you, I mean, Chomsky years ago said, you know, that the U.S. was going to be deciding between sort of, was it going to be trader or, you know, in the sort of Japan style, or was it going to be the enforcer? And it's turned out to be the enforcer. Now, the question whether, you know, is it really just the hawks out of control, or is there something structural? That the book is, you know, tries to be a bit nuanced on that. I mean, we don't say that it was inevitable at all, that there was going to be an invasion as such, and certainly, you know, as you as a political economist know very well, that the modern corporation is not interested in physically owning plant, right? I mean, the fact they're divesting, the modern corporation, far from being proud of making stuff, it doesn't make anything, you know, the canonical, really modern corporation. It brands stuff, and it makes its profits in the circuits, you know. So,
yeah, as my iPod says, designed in California but made in China.
That's terrific. I mean, that's exactly it. So you know, we try to be clear that we want to understand this, the doubleness of this current moment, and I think that tension between, you know, the sort of the Clintonians and the old State Department types, to the extent that they are, you know, they'd be drinking and were friends with people in on Wall Street and in business, the smooth masters of the empire, to the extent that they were in charge as opposed to the war makers. And that there's a tension between them. I think that's definitely true, and there are very, very deep contradictions for business when it comes up against, you know, the enforcement agencies. I mean, what American businessman or woman wants to be endlessly interrupted in their travels, you know, because of the organization of appearances of, you know, safety and security at airports? No, I mean, there are contradictions, and at the level of sort of understanding capitalism and where it's going, these are quite deep questions of dispossession. How to, half the world's is still in a certain kind of way peasantries, and are still yet to be dispossessed, yet to be proletarianized. Although we insist in the book, and that's where we sort of segue into a consideration of Al Qaeda and the opposition that's been most successful to empire at the moment, we could say, and I'm not talking about the movement of movements or those kind of direct actions that many of your listeners have been involved in, but I'm talking about, you know, revolutionary Islam. The breeding grounds for revolutionary Islam are, of course, the megacities that Mike Davis, your friend and mine, has anatomized, you know, so powerfully, you know. Tens of millions. I mean, I was in Cairo just recently, and it's a, you know, which is a mega city at the crossroads of Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, and it's these are sociologically, these places are UFOs. Nobody knows lives of heroic improvisation that people are making. And these are these sites are where now more than half of all humans live. Humanity is living in the cities for the first time in the history of the world, more than half. I mean, we can make a rough guess on that. These aren't natural phenomena. These are the results of structural adjustment and the emptying out of the countrysides by people who are trying desperately to make a go of it, to survive. And nobody knows, I think, you know, certainly ecologically, whether the world can go on this way. We think not. But we have to understand the deeper dynamics of it. And it seems to be a very interesting mixture now of, as I say, what we call, you know, military neoliberalism that's at work.
I'm speaking with Ian Bull, who is one of the authors of the book Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War, just published by Verso. So why does what you call revolutionary Islam or militant Islam or the Islamist global virtual Islam or whatever people call it, why has this become the most visible, most effective form of resistance to these imperial power? But it's not like you know, back when there was a revolutionary movements on the left, it was they sometimes look like the wave of the future. The revolutionary Islam is a very different beast. What do you make of it? Where did it come from and why?
Yes. Well, one of the authors, and we, of course, the four of Retort who sat down to write this pamphlet, which became the book, has spent many years in the oil fields of Nigeria and in the Islamic world, and so and the rest of us felt we had to try to get some handle on this, and certainly the chapter on revolutionary Islam tries to do something to get beyond the, you know, the monolithic sense of Islam and so on, and it's obviously very risky, and we were certainly very aware that there was tremendous danger in putting together at the outset Islam and violence, or conflating, you know, Muslim, Arab, terrorist, and of substituting, you know, a wholly unrepresentative strand of religious orthodoxy for the fantastically complex and heterogeneous firmament of Muslim belief and practice and political expression. That said, we were convinced that in the rush to expose the logic of imperial oil, which is what, of course, a lot of good work did go into looking at that nexus, for sure. We all now know. I mean, who of us, you probably did, but very few of us knew the names Kellogg, Root and Brown, or even Halliburton until recently, and their role in that complex. That's been exposed well, I think. But the left passed over, I think, far too quickly the Islamic constellation, you know, and these mutations and social forces. And we try to face squarely in Afflicted Powers, that the book has just come out, the emergence of a particular mutation of it, the vanguardist left, and to see its genesis in relation to this politics of the whole global Muslim community. And we found something very interesting, which was that, for example, the sort of, you know, the grand old man of revolutionary Islam, of vanguardist Islam, was a very interesting character called, you know, Said Qutb, who wrote a hell of a lot in prison a lot of the time before he was executed. And he brought out, among other things, in 1964, a thing called Signposts Along the Road, where he's very explicit about the need for a vanguard to march through the vast ocean of Jahiliyyah, as he says, which means the state of ignorance preceding and surrounding Islam. And he's very clear about that. But this is a man who, you know, had an epiphany when he came to New York and saw a number of different accounts of this, but saw American racism and the horrors of, you know, as well as, you know, I mean, he looked past the beauties of what our society has here. But And he went back and articulated this, you know, this philosophy, which included large chunks of, you know, Enlightenment thinking. I mean, this is a man who, far from being some utterly sort of demonic other, was deeply immersed in Herder, the Romantics, Morozov, Schmidt, I can't tell, you know, I mean, Aristotle, Marx, Nietzsche, you know, I mean, that's what we found, that the tremendous richness and complexity of the world of Islamism, but that this particular mutation is very interesting and complex, and its power comes partly from the fact that they have rumbled, if you like, the power of the spectacle. You know, that they're not anti-modern, for heaven's sake. I mean, they're drunk with the possibilities of the net and the and websites and the virtual, right? I mean, they're masters at the use of that, seems to me. And so that's what we try to understand. And it's a complicated story, and it's quite a long chapter. But I think we're not well served by the way that, you know, we're invited to think of Islam. And the left in particular hasn't want to face the fact that it's a vanguard, one could even say a kind of a Leninist vanguard that has been, you know, in the grisliest possible way successful in this horrible way. So Retort sets out to understand two enemies, right? Military neoliberalism, you know, capital and empire, of which the U.S. is the hegemon, and on the other side, the opposition that has been most successful in a certain way, revolutionary Islam, in order that we, who align ourselves with a quite other opposition, namely a non-authoritarian, you know, radically democratic humanity, joining together in what we can only call the movement of movements.
And that was Ian Boll, one of the authors writing under the name Retort, of a book called Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back in person next week if Hughes Crick cooperates. Stay tuned for the news. Let's go out with this old song from the Mekons, Where Were You?, a song with no great political import, but one I really like. And it's almost the weekend. Bye.
Standing in a queue, did you see me? You had yellow hair, did you see me?